Talking about the awesomeness of God, we talked about what God is like, we talked about, in particular, His triunity, we talked about why He created us and how His absolute characteristics became relative characteristics with reference to us as they were expressed from Him to us, and we want to move from that just a slight degree to considering how God thinks. And the reason for referencing this is because it's so different from the way that human beings think. Somebody said one time, how odd of God to choose the Jews. And that's true from a human point of view. But God said, I didn't do it because you were a great and mighty nation. If I had, you would have thought you accomplished everything on your own. I selected you because you were small and weak so that I could work through you. As it was said through one of the prophets, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. It's a little bit like what one of our other Daves was saying yesterday with regard to Gideon's army. It would have been thought, perhaps by mankind, that 32,000 soldiers was good, and if you could get more, that would be better. But instead, God took it down just the other way, from 32,000 down to 22,000, and then eventually down to 300, so that God could do what He wanted to do with the situation. It reminds me a little bit of what the apostle said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, that portion there about the 18th verse, that the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks wisdom. Jesus wasn't anybody's idea of how God would handle the situation with regard to the salvation of the world. Unto the Jews a stumbling block. Why? Because they'd always been saved by a miracle. When they were a people living in Egyptian bondage, with the lash of the taskmaster's whip, bearing down on their bare backs beneath the burning sun of Egypt with those flails that we saw yesterday in the slides, beating down upon them. They were saved by a tenfold demonstration of the miraculous power of God. When they were out in the wilderness and didn't have enough to eat, they were saved by miracle again. The manna was such a remarkable miracle that on the Friday they could gather twice as much as usual and it would carry them over the Sabbath day. No other day could they do that or it would breed worms. But on the Friday they could do that and it would carry them over. God always took care of them by demonstrations of power. But Jesus hanging on the cross was no demonstration of power. Rather, it was a demonstration of futility and weakness. And so the Jews found Jesus to be a stumbling block because He didn't seem to be the demonstration of power that they expected. And under the Greeks, it was foolishness. Foolishness to the Greeks because Jesus hadn't graduated from a philosophic school. Jesus was not a demonstration of human reasoning. And so people have always tended to be confused by the thinking of God. It's a little bit, again, like what Samuel experienced when he went to the household of Jesse looking for somebody to anoint. And we would have thought, perhaps, that the nation would have had enough of tall, dark, and handsome by this time, having experienced King Saul. But he came in there and they saw the oldest son, the one who looked like he should be the next king, perhaps. And first thing Samuel says, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. The Lord said, no, that's not him. So they go down to Abinadab, and no, it's not him. Go to Shammah, no, it's not him. Go on through seven sons, no, it's not any of these. Well, do you have any more sons? One's out tending the sheep, almost dismissively said, perhaps. But he turned out to be the one who was after God's heart, and the statement was made there that the Lord seeth not as man seeth. For man looketh upon the outward appearance, but God looketh upon the heart. Such an important point of distinction in the way that God thinks and the way that man thinks, the way that God sees and the way that man sees. There's always an attitude on the part of human beings that wants to take over what God has planned and try to work out ways to make it work better, to make it more efficient, to make it more seemingly effective quicker. not realizing that God is at least as concerned with the process as he is with the product that comes out at the end. He's at least as concerned with how we do things as he is with what it is that gets done. He's concerned with both of those things. And it's important that we have an attitude that's aligned with the way that God thinks and recognize what is important to God. That's having a heart after God. God selected the man who had a heart after him, even though he was the youngest in his family and was out tending the sheep. And we need to remember that that's the way that God operates. This statement was made with regard to how God thinks in the 55th chapter of the book of Isaiah, that as the heavens are above the earth, so are my ways above your ways and my thoughts above your thoughts. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways. The other part I quoted comes a little bit later in that same chapter there. So we have to understand that we need to align our thinking with God's rather than assuming that God would think the way we do in order to get things done quickly, in order to get things done in a way that seems right to us. And I'm stressing this because we've always had a problem with this idea throughout the history of the world. We go way back to the beginning and talk about Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4 for just a second. And we don't have any reason there to believe that Cain had been living a wicked life up to the time that we experience this story. But we are told that by faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, Hebrews 11, verse 4. Now, if it was by faith, we know that they'd been told what to do, because Romans 10, 17 teaches us that faith cometh by hearing the word of God. Faith cometh by hearing the word of God, and so if Abel offered his sacrifice by faith, he must have been told what to do, and he pleased God with that offering, God also testifying of his gifts. Pleased God, and unto Cain and his offering the Lord had not respect. Cain offered what he worked with every day, and I can understand what his reasoning might have been, because this is the way man thinks. Abel's going to offer what he works every day. He's a shepherd, and so I'll offer what I work with every day. I'm a farmer, and so I'll bring the best first fruits of my crop, just as Abel's going to bring the best that he has to offer. And that seems right. There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death, because the Lord seeth not as man seeth, and because his thoughts are not our thoughts. That's why he gave us his thoughts, so that we can go by them rather than what would occur to us otherwise. But I can understand what Cain's view may well have been. I don't think that there's a note of rebellion here necessarily at this point. It's just that if Abel is going to offer what he works with every day, so I'll do the same thing. And he may well have thought that it just didn't make any difference. They're both, after all, burnt offerings to the Lord. It was voluntary. There's no indication anybody made either one of them do this. But this points up the problem in using our own judgment with reference to things that God has spoken about, because his thoughts are not the same as our thoughts. And once we get started down the wrong track, then often reproof will not bring us back. And usually the person that reproves us is looked askance at by us. In this case, there was no human reprover involved in the process. God reproved Cain himself, and Cain still wouldn't come clean with him. He couldn't get back at God about it, and so he went out and killed his brother. Points up the difficulty that people have in laying aside their own personal thoughts and ideas and judgments for the safety of doing things the way that God has said to do them, because his thoughts are not our thoughts. We find this same spirit in other places as well. In the 13th chapter of 1 Samuel, we find the case of Saul, king of Israel, who was waiting for Samuel to come and offer the sacrifice before they could go out to war. This had been decreed as the way to do it a long time before. And Saul's waiting and waiting around for Samuel to come and offer the sacrifice. And his army begins to go off one way or another, because there's nothing harder to do in the face of an enemy than just sit and wait and not be able to do anything. So he's losing some of his army, and it looks like he's not going to have anybody left at all to help him fight the Philistines, and he's demoralized in the face of this waiting. And so rather than just sit and not do anything, because he knew that these Philistine warriors were well trained. They'd ruled over God's people for a while, and this was such an important thing to get done, and Saul was so worried about it, rather than not do anything, since he knew he couldn't go to battle before the sacrifice had been offered and his people were leaving, he went ahead and offered him the sacrifice himself, even though he had no right to do that. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. But instead of waiting any longer, he says, I'll just do it myself. Because he was frustrated. And you can understand that, can't you? You can understand it individually. You can understand it congregationally. Have you ever heard people in a congregation say, well, I know he's not quite qualified, but he's the best we've got. Can't we appoint him to the eldership anyway? I've heard that several times. Because we just get so frustrated. We can't cause the growth that we'd like to see there. And so let's just go ahead and take the shortcut. It's appealing. It's not done in a spirit of rebellion ordinarily. It's done in the spirit of let's just get something done. And I can identify with that. Human judgment entering the divine arrangements and resulting in actions that aren't right. Saul wanted what was best here. He just forgot that it's better to wait than it is to do wrong. And ironically, you could almost predict it. Just as Saul had finished up making the offering, here came Samuel anyway. If Saul had just waited a little longer, it would have been fine. God is not a fool. He knows what to do and how to do it. And every time we get the idea of short-circuiting something in order to produce a result that seems desirable, then we get into trouble. Saul knew that in his better moments. But he lapsed here. He was not the one to offer the sacrifice, but he tried it out anyway. Now we have a little bit different example in the case of Korah in Numbers chapter 16. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram thought that since they were from the tribe of Levi, that they ought to be able to offer the incense as well. Human intervention into divine arrangements. Moses, you take too much on yourself. Here's the way we want to do it. And where did instrumental music in the church come from? Wasn't it exactly the same as this kind of a spirit? Is it really any different than the spirit of Cain? And how many churches that started out using instrumental music in their corporate worship and praise to God ever gave it up because they said God didn't require it and it's not safe for us to use it? Once we start down that pathway of our own thinking and leave God's thinking behind, then we usually don't go back and change. Man really hasn't changed over the years. These things we're reading about that happened thousands of years ago are still happening all around us now. We've got the human mind presuming and assuming and substituting, helping God out. Thinking sometimes, how did God ever get along without us? How did the church even last for 2,000 years before I got here to make sure that everything would just be the way it ought to be? God's way won't work. It has to have my help. We have to make these alterations or these changes. And the assumption in this is that God didn't know. God didn't know what the 21st century was going to be like as we go into it. This was all set down a long time ago. He didn't understand what things were going to be like in our own time. He didn't understand what modern challenges we were going to face. And that's been the cry from the beginning, that these are the old ways. We need to do something new and different now. God's way is all right, provided we make this or that modification to it. But God doesn't need that kind of help from us. The kind of action that God requires of us is to work his plan, not change his plan. If he has you and has me wholeheartedly, then as long as we do what he said, things are fine. But there's a difference between doing what he says and letting him work through us. Difference between that and trying to help him out by asserting our own ideas and presumptions, even though we mean well. It's like a little girl in the kitchen who wants to help her mother make the pie, and her mother says, no, I'm busy, we're having company, so you can't help me this time, you can help me next time, but not this time. And her mother's stirring up the ingredients there, and when the doorbell rings and the mother goes to the door, then the little girl gets up on the counter and helps her mother out anyway. But when the mother comes back to the kitchen, she has to start all over, because although the little girl meant well, it didn't work out the way she intended it. And we're like the little child. All we know is what the Lord has said. We don't know anything beyond that. And we don't know enough about his plan to change anything. There may be things that neither you nor I see about the way God, the reason that God had for the way that he did things. We've already seen that there are some questions we have no information about at all, others that we can only partially answer. And none of us are really very astute when it comes to comprehending completely why God has set the church as he did. And yet the New Testament tells us that it was no accident, it was no afterthought. Everything was planned and arranged a long time beforehand. It's difficult for people to lay aside their own ideas and judgments for the safety of the church, because we stand around it and we just ache to help it out. Well, we're not converting as many people as we ought to. We're not getting this done, we're not getting that done. And that's right. We can all, I hope, appreciate the feeling. We should all feel this way to some extent. But we have to learn to labor within the Lord's parameters, and sometimes just to wait and let God give the increase and take care of things in his own time, rather than make changes that will in the short term seem to be successful, and yet in the long run cause what used to be the Lord's church to turn out to be something far different than that. In the case of Abraham, he and Sarah faced the same sort of an issue and found out the hard way that there were always reasons for the way the Lord did things. Often we just don't know the reasons. It's still just as true today as it was then. Abraham was 75 years old when he left his home, told to get away from his kindred, but he took his father and his brother with him, which apparently seemed best to him at the time. Took his kindred with him even though he left the land. So there's only partial obedience there. And he had no seed. He had Lot that was kindred with him, and God blessed Abraham. When Lot left, just as soon as he got rid of Lot, and he only got rid of Lot because the issue was forced, their help couldn't get along. And Abraham was very kind to Lot. You're aware of the story. Just as soon as Lot left, it was, lift up now thine eyes, Abraham, look north, south, east, and west. I'm going to give you all this land. As soon as he had completed his obedience, then God blessed him as he promised that he would. So they got to the place where Abraham was 85 and Sarah was 75, and Sarah decided that the promise that had been made about seed for Abraham needed some human help, because it was getting late. The God of the universe has made this promise, and he's not going to be able to keep it unless we help. This is a problem that is often faced, and there is a tight line of distinction here. Yes, God wants our help in doing his will, but he doesn't want us to change his plan in order to implement that help. And that's the mistake that Sarah made. Abraham, you know, when we were down in Egypt and we got in trouble down there when you lied, or at least half lied, about me being your sister. And you didn't mention that I was also your wife. And so we got into trouble. In order to kind of buy us off, the Pharaoh sent us out with all kinds of slaves and so forth. Why don't you take that slave girl from Egypt, Hagar, and have a son by her, and we'll just pretend that that's the chosen seed. And that way, God won't have gone so far out on a limb and sawed it off that he won't be able to keep his promise. So Abraham didn't have any word from God on that issue. What he had was the word of Sarah. And he took the word of Sarah and went into Hagar. And sure enough, a son was produced. And nothing, as far as we know, was said about it by God until Abraham was 99 years old and Sarah was 89. And then God said, Sarah shall have a son. Now here's a woman who I think really meant well. What woman wants to give her husband another wife? And yet Sarah was willing to do this at great personal expense because she wanted to help God. She wanted God's will to be done, and she thought this was the only way it could happen. She forgot that God doesn't think, God doesn't operate like human beings do, that God's not limited by the things we're limited by. And she started saying, it's my fault. God made a promise, and I can't fulfill it. It's been 10 years. Abraham's not getting any younger. So she gave her husband another wife. She loved God. She loved her husband. She meant well. And it seemed like when Ishmael was born that Sarah had saved the situation. And then when Abraham was 99 and Sarah was 89, God said, Sarah will have a son. And Sarah learned that it was all for naught. Here's a woman that gave her husband another wife and endured that wife for 14 years. And now she finds out that she didn't even need to go through that, that it was just a complication in the process. They found out they're going to have this son. Abraham laughed. Sarah laughed too. They had to live with that name, laughter, for the next 75 years of Abraham's life, because Isaac means laughter. Finally, at the age of 100, God gave Abraham the promised seed. And he did it at the time in their lives when it was absolutely impossible, humanly speaking, for that to happen, because God wanted man to know that it was God doing it and not man. God never used the fruit of Hagar's womb as his promised seed. God let them know that he could do it without their help, but he had to wait until they couldn't do it, until he could do it. And so often, people have to get to the place where they can't do anything until they're willing for God to do. And then they'll let God work in them, but they've wasted all that time. We go down to the next generation here, and we see the same sort of an issue with Rebekah and her son Jacob. It was said while the boys Jacob and Esau were still in the womb that the elder shall serve the younger. And Rebekah knew what the promise was. She knew how things were supposed to happen. But she couldn't see how they were going to happen. And so she decided that some lying and deception would be in order to bring about the greater good. It was just a means to an end, that's all. And she meant well. The promised seed was to be in Jacob, not Esau. But Rebekah's got to find a way to make that happen, she thought. You know, Jacob really never got anything of Isaac's, as it turned out. But the point here is that God would have taken care of it. When God makes a promise, he'll take care of fulfilling it. With all that Rebekah did, with all that Jacob did, with his lying, saying he was Esau and all that, they didn't do any good for the Lord in that instance, although they meant well. Go a little further along, get to the book of Exodus and beyond. Moses was a man who was faithful in all God's house, spoke face to face with God. He was the spokesman from God to man, the mediator of the old covenant, the man who stood in the gap for the people when God threatened to destroy them. From all indications, here is a man who could have been the next Pharaoh himself. But the Hebrew letter, chapter 11, tells us that he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Here's a man who was the best educated of his generation, a man who was trained for leadership, fitted to command men, and at the age of 40 had everything going for him. At the age of 40, he chose the people of God over the Egyptian people. He was physically powerful, enough so that he could kill the Egyptian taskmaster. He was known by all the high officials. He was zealous for the cause of God. But Moses wasn't ready because he had to learn the lesson of patience. He was astonished that the children of Israel rebuked him. You're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Who made you a judge and a divider over us? They didn't want to be led. And so Moses, by that, was forced to flee and become a shepherd for 40 years down in the land where his eventual father-in-law, Jethro, lived. A man to lead the children of Israel and who thought he was ready, but now he's leading the lambs and the ewes and the rams along. And from the height of power, he is reduced to watching animals feed. Those 40 years go by. And now God sends him back to Egypt. But it seems strange to do it after 40 years, doesn't it? When he was 40 years old, he had influence with all the people that were down there. Now at the age of 80, who's going to even remember him? You've had a whole generation pass away. Not too long ago, I ran into a man in a cemetery that I graduated from high school with, and I tried to convince him that we went to high school together. I don't think he ever did believe me, because I don't look like I did when I was in high school. He still did, but I don't look like I did when I was in high school anymore. I'm not sure he ever did really believe that I was who I said I was. And that was after only 20-some years. After 40 years, when Moses goes back to Egypt, who knows him there? An 80-year-old man coming down to tell the Pharaoh of Egypt what to do. When he was 40 years old, he was so zealous that he was killing, trying to, acting like he was trying to start killing the Egyptians one by one by himself. When he was 80, he had such a lack of zeal that he didn't even want to go. God told him to go repeatedly. He came up with five different excuses not to go down to the land of Egypt, not to try to get the people out. And God had to convince him, give him his brother to take with him, and show him that the power was in the staff. Moses had it all at the age of 40. He wasn't usable, though, by God until he was 80. Because not only was Moses different, but God had already set a time for the people to be delivered from Egyptian bondage. So often we may just not know what the Lord has in mind with regard to timing and chronology. I'm slow of speech. Meekest man on earth. Send Aaron with him. Moses and Aaron, two old men and a stick of wood, going in to tell the Pharaoh of Egypt what to do. A strong man may think that he can go do it, but God sent a man to Egypt who knew he couldn't do it by himself. Here we have the difference between the judgment of man and the judgment of God, the thinking of man and the thinking of God. How are the little Israelites ever going to be able to fight the Egyptians and get away? But God arranged a way where they never did have to fight the Egyptians. God said, I'll fight them myself. And it may be that some of those weapons that the Egyptians had with them washed up on the shore, and the Egyptians got to take those. I'm not sure about that, but if that's not where they got their weapons, I'm not sure where they did get them. They didn't have to fight the Egyptians. God worked it out. And when God has made a promise, or when God has given us a way to go, faith means that we work within the parameters of that, no matter how things seem. And we wait for God to give what increase or to do what he's supposed to do. We just retain a faithfulness to him. Now, it's always natural to have a rebellion against restraints, an unwillingness to accept what are regarded as outworn ideas or things that are outmoded, throwing things away simply because they're old. I want to, for a moment here, contrast a couple of kinds of government, because I think this well indicates to us the way that God thinks and how different that is from the usual thinking of man. During the time of Joshua, the people served the Lord well. But as soon as the old men were dead, then we have the same thing happening that tends to happen in every generation. As the older generation begins to die off, the younger generation comes along feeling modern. And of course, they are modern. At whatever point in time you are, it's modern. And we got a bunch of new ideas, a new bunch of ways of doing things, a new bunch of approaches. And that happened in that generation as well, just as soon as the old men died. The younger generation went looking for something else. So the Chaldeans came in, and they ruled over them for about 8 years until the people couldn't take it. They cried out, and God sent a deliverer by the name of Othniel, who was one of the judges. And for 40 years, things went reasonably well there. Well, Othniel got to the place where he now was the old-timer, and he died off. And the people regarded him as being out of date. They wanted to be more modern and up-to-date. And so they went off into idolatry. The Moabites came and ruled them for 18 years, and they cried out. There came a deliverer by the name of Ehud. We see this happening over and over again. They served the Canaanites for 20 years. Deborah comes along for 40 years. You've got the old people dying off. The new generation has to always learn the same lesson all over again. Finally, the Midianites have been in there for 7 years. The people are having to hide in or live in caves. Along comes Gideon. We've talked about how he fought the battle with the Gideonites with just 300 rather than 32,000 men as a judge rather than as a king. And the thinking of God here in implementation. Tola, Jair. When Jair died, the people about went crazy. We go on and on to the time of Samuel. And when we come to 1 Samuel chapter 8, the people come to Samuel and say, oh, you're old. You're real old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Why don't you make us a king, that he may rule over us and we may be like the nations round about us? Everybody else got a king. We're the only ones who don't. We feel odd. We're self-conscious over here. We want to be like the nations that are round about us. We can ask why, looking back, why would you want to be like those nations? Archaeologically, we dig things up and we see what problems those nations had. Why would you want to be? Well, the reason for wanting to be like those nations is because they were embarrassed not to be. That's the trouble. And human beings have not changed one bit. God said to Samuel, perhaps in an attempt to comfort him, don't take it personally. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. They don't want me to be the king over them. The problems the people saw with the judgeship were many. There was a lack of a centralized government, and there was a lack of a consistent and consecutive government. People did what was right in their own eyes. There were times of some anarchy in areas where they failed to follow God in particular. But they were not able to develop a strong standing military power under the judges. Of course, the case of Gideon shows that they didn't need that as long as they walked with God. You go to the land of, you go to the place you're supposed to go three times a year, and I'll see that everything's protected. God was already taking care of them as long as they walked with him. But they wanted more assurance than that. They wanted to be able to do things their own way and still had a king as a figurehead to lead them out to battle. And so they didn't have the military armaments. They didn't have all the modern chariots that all the other nations had. They lacked a standing army with professional officers. They lacked the organization to be great commercially. They lacked all the pomp and circumstance, the glory, the national pride, that uniting figurehead that the king would provide. And they thought that was so important. And so they asked for a king. They were warned that if you get a king, he'll take your sons and call them soldiers. He'll take your daughters and call them cooks. He'll take your money and call it taxes. It's not going to be the panacea you think it is. But the people said, that's fine. We want a king anyway. This contrast was set before their eyes. But they weren't listening. And so now they got a king. They do have a central government. They become one nation. They have a unifying city in the second generation of kings. And they've got a consistency in government. Once they had a king, they always had a king or a queen until they were taken away into captivity. They had a standing military power which became something to be reckoned with in their little part of the world. The historical archives of the other nations speak of the record of the mighty kings of Israel on occasion. They were successful commercially, especially under Solomon's time. They had all the pomp, all the circumstance, and the glory to delight the hearts of the people. Everything just looked wonderful to him. And all the deficiencies were taken care of, they could well have thought. But that wasn't the way that God looked at the situation. And the chinks in the armor began to become evident very soon. But this is the mind of man. We see the deficiencies as we perceive them, and so we set about to correct them. Let's see what happened. As soon as they had a centralized government, they were just that much more open to every perversion of idolatry than they had been before. They were open enough before. But now that they had this greater and stronger communication, they were more tightly bound together. Then when one area went wrong, others tended to go wrong quicker because they had a king to follow. When Solomon went wrong, it was that much easier for everybody else to go wrong because there is an influence there. There's no way around it. When I was a kid, the President of the United States, John Kennedy, didn't wear a hat. Prior to that time, men tended to wear hats. You'd see a row of hats along the back row of any church house. Kennedy didn't wear a hat. Sales of men's hats plummeted in the country, and they never have bounced back since. It's not an issue of which is right or wrong, good or bad. It's completely neutral. But I'm just talking about the influence. Jackie Kennedy wore a pillbox hat. Sales skyrocketed because of her influence. They were the closest thing to royalty that we had. And there is an influence there. And when the king did or said something right or wrong, there was an influence. And you're not going to have a godly king for more than one generation very often, because when he dies, then you get his son, who is often a wastrel for some reason. So this was the problem that God foresaw that apparently man did not foresee. With this tight binding, this figurehead to lead, human figurehead, is a problem. The same thing happens today when you've got congregations that are supposed to be autonomous from one another, and they get tightly bound together. And especially if you have some preacher somewhere who is a unifying figurehead, and he goes astray in some way or the other, then you see people in mob action almost following after that. The more open they are to being turned away and misled, because that's the way people function. And you know yourself personally, some of you, that a cancer in your body is not always easily isolated. People became subject to the influence of the king, and as long as we're just one big body and have this tight, close influence together, they began to depend on the king instead of God. It turned out that the weakness of the judges was the very protection of the people. And then when they had kings, what they thought would be so wonderful is actually the instrument that the devil was able to use to lead them astray. The weakness of the judgeship was its very strength. Thomas Jefferson was the man who said, that government governs best which governs least. And that may not be true in every detail, but as a general principle, there's a lot to be said for that. Under the judges, the people had to depend on God. But the very military power that the kings fostered through greater and greater taxation became the exhaustion of the nation. They made a lot of entangling alliances with other nations which worshipped other gods. And the thing that they had thought was a weakness in their government was the thing that had kept on causing them to return to God, because they had no place else to turn. But now that they've got a king, they turn to the king and they follow his direction. Just think of the kings. Saul had problems. David created problems. Solomon set an example of idolatry that spread very quickly because he was the king. The kingship was so dangerous to the children of Israel that it was only because God placed a counterbalance against it, that is, the national prophets, that they could even continue to exist as a nation. Had God not given them the national prophets as an offsetting to the power of the kings, then the kings would have become tyrants, and the children of Israel, north and south, would have gone into captivity, had to go into captivity a lot sooner than they did. God placed the national prophets there in order to counterbalance that and make the process take longer, make the devolution of the empire take a longer time, because the kings were afraid of the prophets, and with good reason. Jeroboam got met by a prophet whose name we're not even sure of, and when he started to say, he drew back a withered hand because of the power that that prophet had. Every David had his Nathan to point the finger at him and say, thou art the man. Every Saul had a Samuel to declare unto him, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Every Ahab had his Elijah. Every Ahaz had his Isaiah. And had it not been for the national prophets, the children of Israel would have had no protection at all. But the prophets were not what the children of Israel wanted, and they certainly were not inherent in the idea of the kingship at all. All things being equal, the kingship was a disaster for the people of Israel. But it came about because the mind of man saw a way to improve on the thinking of God. They didn't really gain anything by it, but they thought that it was going to be so wonderful. Under the judges, when they suffered, they'd always come back to God. And as long as they served God, they had judges to lead them with what leadership they needed. But you can't lead anybody who doesn't want to go. So much of this has to do with the pride of life, which is not of the Father, but is of the world. The pride of life. Make us a king so that we're not embarrassed because we're different. Make us a king so we can blend in with everybody else. Under the judgeship, they were sustained as long as they served God. But after the kingdom divided, the nation of Israel in the north never had one good king. They had 9 different dynasties of kings, 19 kings in all up there, never had one good king. The mind that desired a king brought disaster to the people. And many times in trying to improve the working of the Lord's plan, we look at the church as it exists and as it is set up to exist in the Bible, and we see the inherent weaknesses, or what seem to be the weaknesses in it. And we set about to establish ways to overcome those weaknesses or the disadvantages or the problems that we see, trying to accomplish a thing, maybe even attempting to be scriptural about it, when maybe the principle behind the thing that we're doing is antagonistic to the simplicity of the Lord's plan. Because none of us are physicians when it comes to repairing the Lord's body. There's only one great physician. And we may make the mistake, meaning well, of trying to help God out when we don't even know what we're doing. When my van won't run right, I don't want just anybody under the hood changing this and changing that, because some of you, well, probably all of you know more about it than I do, but some of you may not know too much more about it than I do. I want somebody under there that has an idea and may have a possibility of making things better. So when we think that the church is not functioning as it should, and that we're failing because of a weakness in the church, we have to well define what we mean by that. That's true if we're looking at ourselves and the weaknesses in ourselves that keep us from implementing the Lord's plan. But if we're talking about a weakness in the plan, then we need to go back to square one. The very weakness that God seems to have built in to the church is its very protection. We have to believe and remember that God had a reason for everything he did and everything he gave. The mind of God, the way that God thinks, is not as man thinks. And even if you're a godly person, it may be that there are differences between the way God thinks and the way that you think. God had as much purpose for the things that he left out of the church as he did for the things that he put into it. God knew what he wanted. He'd been planning it for a long time, and he doesn't make mistakes. And there may well be something involved that you or I just are not capable of seeing. The time we get into problems with this is when we find ourselves dissatisfied. And it may be that the more zealous you are for the work of the Lord, the more easily you are dissatisfied with things as they are, with the status quo. That would be normal. Same thing was true back in the Old Testament. In fact, it's true of every leaving of the truth. Back in the days of the Exodus, God provided for their needs, the quail, the manna, but they didn't like that. They remember the leeks and the garlic, the onions, back in Egypt, the flesh pots of Egypt, how wonderful it was back there. They hated it while they were there, but it seems wonderful now that they're here. Wherever we are, we've always got one foot somewhere else. That's the way man thinks. And they forgot how bad it was. They remember the good things, or they make it up. And we can be the same way in the church. Do you want to go back to Egypt? Sometimes we get to thinking that the world looks pretty good, and the quail and the manna that the Lord provides aren't that great. But we have to remember to ask ourselves, am I here to please myself, or am I here to please God? Do I come to the assembly to get something out of it, or do I come to put something into it? Where is my greater focus? We have to be careful about dissatisfaction, being dissatisfied with God's protection. While God was protecting them and would have allowed them to overcome any odds, they were afraid to go in and take the land because they said, we're like grasshoppers in the sight of these people. And then just as soon as God said, all right, don't go in and take it, I'm going to leave you and I'm not going to allow you to take it, then they wanted to go in and they tried to go in and take it, and they were rebuffed. When God had left them in disgust and told them they couldn't take it, they went in and tried to take it. Absolutely amazingly similar to us. Dissatisfaction with the leadership of God. Aaron, make us gods. As for this Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. We see the same dissatisfaction today. The time will come, it was predicted by the apostle, that they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust will heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears. Our soul loatheth this light bread. We just can't take it anymore. The same dissatisfaction today. And so when you go back to your home congregations and you get back to business as usual and you begin to get discouraged, when you begin to get dissatisfied with the way that things go in the church, and we all ought to get dissatisfied with the way things normally go in the church, but we have to be very careful with that emotion and with the energy that comes from it, because that's the time we're most susceptible to following the bad examples we've been talking about all day. I challenge you to look at the history of the people of God the last 2,000 years and find one thing about the church that somebody didn't change because they got discouraged somewhere along the line. I don't think you can do that. When you do what God wants you to do because he's God, that's faith. When you say, not my will, but thine be done, and Lord, I'm going to do your will, even if it seems like there's no good coming of it, then that's faith, and that's wonderful. What we really need is to grow up to that point and recognize what our position is and what God's position is. That God has a plan, you and I are merely the instruments in his hand to implement that plan, and that results are not our business. Doing the work is our business. Faithfulness is our business. We spell success faithfulness. We don't spell success by numbers. We don't spell it in any way except remaining faithful to God and doing his work. Otherwise, we've got the wrong thinking. We're like David trying to get the ark down to Jerusalem, where he knew he wanted it. He knew God wanted it there. Yes, God wanted it there. And so the way to get it down there is the quickest way possible. Put it on a cart and bring it down. Makes perfect sense to me. I'm sure it does to you. But it didn't make any sense to God. And we have the problem of thinking how God is so awesome that surely God is bigger than little ringlets and poles and the shoulders of Levi. Surely God's bigger than that. But God said he's not bigger than that. It was important enough that he said it in the first place, and it was important enough to follow. I don't know what's already been done. And all I need to think about is doing what it was that he spoke. So when we say that the church is failing, such and such a thing is desperately needed. Look at all the people who are going to hell because we're not doing this or that. Therefore, we're justified in making this change or that change. The church could do it, yes, but the church isn't doing it. Therefore, we need this other thing, this other institution, organization, whatever it is. That's a critical point in our decision making. Are you going to trust that God will fulfill his promises through you if you do what he said? That leaven works by touching the corpuscle next to it, and it works quietly and adroitly without attracting a lot of attention to himself. Are you going to attract, going to trust for that? Or are you going to say, like Sarah did, I can't do it. The Lord made this promise, but he can't do it through me because of my own personal failings. Therefore, I'm going to give the Lord another bride, and it will do what I can't do because I failed. Because God can't do it through me. When the reality is that the church does not fail because it lacks evangelists or elders or teachers. The local congregation fails because it lacks mature Christians. And what we really need is just for the brethren to grow up and work. And everything else will fall into place. Everything will take care of itself. You and I can grow in faith and zeal, and we can work. Let's work, and if we work, then we'll be doing the most that we can. In the day of judgment, we will not be found lacking. Please be back at 11:05.